So the Exner created a sort of a monster that created a monster in the sense that you had to, you were forced to try to emulate. Was the 57 Chrysler a success commercially, or was it just a
well, as I as I recall, it created a big flash in the showroom.
Right.
Now, how far it went beyond that, I can't say.
But when you all went to see it, you said, oh, well, you bet.
Yeah. It really stood out. And so we had to do something about it. Our 58s were pretty well along, so there wasn't much we could do with that.
You're talking about Chevrolet?
Chevrolet.
Yeah.
And so then we poured everything we could into the 59. Now, there was a little thing here. In 58, our 58 car was an all-new car.
Mm-hmm.
And it only ran 1 year, and that was unheard of. The reason it only ran for 1 year was that somebody at that time got the idea that maybe we should be sharing things between different divisions. So it came out that Chevrolet would join Pontiac and Buick and Oldsmobile in common bodies under the skin.
Was that the first time that was that was devised?
Yeah. And what that meant to Chevrolet was that they were then stuck with a bigger car.
Uh-huh.
And probably a more expensive car, since you're going to have Buicks and Olds and Pontiac inputs in it.
Right.
And so this was a pretty hard thing for them to swallow. But anyway, they got that assignment. And that's the way it went.
Who decided?
Well, it was decided at the General Motors Policy Committee meeting.
Is it time saver and cost saver?
Yeah, and maybe it was, and maybe it wasn't. I don't know. It probably was for Buick and Olds.
But not for Chevrolet.
Maybe not for Chevrolet.
You were losing your distinctive
Well, no, but we had our own appearance.
That's what I mean. I see.
Under the skin, there were some things that they had to carry. I think it worked out all right. Incorporated in that car were some of the things that came out of our competition, like the Plymouth. And they were a little bit lower, and we had to make up for that somehow inside, either by shrinking the people that were in it or lowering the seats, which we finally did. And we got complaints from our customers that the seats were lowered to the floor. And
when you say lowering the seats, lowering the floor pan?
Well, it can only be lowered so far.
Right. Uh-huh.
Until it runs into the chassis or the ground.
Right. Uh-huh.
And so the seat was actually lowered to the floor.
Uh-huh.
So that you sit
for
sports car like.
High seats.
Chair height.
Yeah. Sports car.
Yeah. And we went a little too far on those. But it wasn't just styling that did it. It was the corporation agreed on it. Sometimes under duress, but
mm-hmm.
they agreed.
What did Ed Cole think of this? Was he unhappy using some of the lines of the film?
Well, Ed Cole was an optimist. You know, he figured, well, we'll make out some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that he sort of enjoyed the fact that Chevrolet was going to be a little bit bigger. That was still better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Longer, lower, and wider.
Mm-hmm. He succumbed to the thin craze too.
Well, that started on the 1957 Chevrolet,
right,
as far as he was concerned. And then we went to the curved out one. In conjunction with that, our 1958 Chevrolet was meant to be a huskier, heavier, more solid looking car. Was that way, and that's the year that we brought out the Impala Coupe, if you remember that, which was a convertible and a hardtop.
Tell us about that. How did it come about?
Well, he wanted something special in the Chevrolet line, something higher priced, something better.
You had the Bel Air.
Up to that time, we had Biscayne, the Bel Air. And then we brought out the Impala. And
gives you an image, the name gives you an image, you know, which was picked deliberately, but what he had in mind.
don't know. Well, I remember how the Impala name came about. We had internal meetings.
Yes.
Selecting names. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody would spend a day or two just collecting names.
This is Indy style. This is not Charlie.
Yeah. And I don't know if it was Carl Renner or Bob Cadaret, C-A-D-A-R-E-T, who was still at Jamestown.
Is it?
That first suggested that name. But I do remember at a meeting where Jules Andrade was, that we suggested the name Impala. Nothing damn goat.
But very stylish and swift. Kind of
cool. Yeah. In fact, I have a skin hanging by my house up here.
Oh, the Dallas skin. Very swift and has long...
very fast.
Very fast and has long and curvy horns.
Well, our...
Your
emblem.
Your emblem introduced that. Okay, how'd that come about? Someone said, well, we've got
I guess we I guess we looked in a encyclopedia and found a picture of it or a book.
And went out from
there. Yeah. But that was a lot of fun working in that car.
So that was the top of line, man. That was
the top of the line was.
How many pieces did you have in that series? Was it just the one introductory hardtop coupe?
Hardtop coupe and convertible. And strangely enough, you see very few of those around the road today. I don't.
57s or 58.
58 Impalas. There aren't many, but they're very expensive. Hard to get.
Well, what sort of reception did you get?
Oh, fine.
Seemed to be there's quite a
people love sensation. Yeah. One of the things that we had on it was an air outlet behind the rear, over the rear backlight.
Uh-huh.
And it was meant to exhaust the air, and this was meant to be a functional thing. So when you're air conditioning was on, or your air inlets, the air would have a place to go with the windows closed.
Oh, okay. Couldn't help the smokers in the car.
Well, and so we built mock-ups of it, sent them to the proving ground, or the division did, Chevrolet did,
right.
And they found that the air came back through it.
Oh, no. Backed up on you.
So they just closed it up and left the ornamentation.
Oh, no. Too bad. It wasn't the first inside air.
Very solid looking car.
Who worked on the Impala? Design room?
Well,
beside yourself.
Carl Renner, Bob Cadaret. They're the two that had the most to do with it.
Right.
And they were both involved in the Nomad station wagon. The studio operation called for design engineering on the model and clay model.
And then you would send it to the fabrication department.
That's right. From that time, from the clay model, they would send it to the fabrication shop and they would make a plaster.
Full size plaster. And paint it. Would that be the final?
Well, or they make a cast of it and make fiberglass from that mold. I think about that time we were into fiberglass.
You make a plaster cast. Then you make a fiberglass mold.
Right.
Would that be full size?
Or sometimes that would all be done in the studio. The cast would be made in the studio. Then they'd take that into the fabrication area to make the fiberglass.
So when did you introduce fiberglass into your final models?
Well, I think it was in the 58.
It worked beautifully for the Corvette.
Yeah.
And so, what would you do in order to prepare that for a final approval? opinion of things.
Well, the first approval would come from the clay.
From the clay, right, yeah.
And you could paint clay.
Right.
But it, you know, you destroyed it when you painted it. When you tried to clean the paint.
Yeah, right.
It would have to be redone. Then other approvals would be gotten from fiberglass.
Harley Earl, meaning in the early days of the Art and Public Division of GM, pioneered with clay. Previous to that, they'd done wood models.
Yes, I can remember prior to the war, when I first went to General Motors, seeing some pieces of some wood models.
Right.
And that was a lot of work, just doing what they did.
You had wood pattern.
Yes, very skilled people,
yeah.
Just extremely.
The old conditioned company.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that would be laborious and time-consuming. So the Earl's innovation was it not? That he had used clay in California.
That's right, yeah.
A special type of clay.
Right. There were a few manufacturers of clay that we got our material from.
Yeah. Someone described to me, Robert Murray described that before the advent of electric ovens, you had to heat the clay in buckets of
water.
Water, yeah, boiling water.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Then they could slather it on. But very soon, I'm sure by the time you started electric ovens.
Yeah, it might have been that was he dealing with cord or auburn at the time?
Yeah, right.
So it may have been that they didn't have
the
wherewithal to do
those things. Was there one future company that supplied the clay?
I think there was. I don't remember who it was.
Chevron company?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. Yeah.
So you had a pretty good core of clay models then?
Oh yeah, they were really good.
Are these the unsung heroes? Couldn't get along with that.
No, you could.
They were responsive, hardworking.
All those things.
Yeah.
We were a team.
So perhaps at this point, can you describe briefly in capsule the process, starting with the concept? Would you get a concept about this time that product planners were coming into existence?
We didn't have product planners.
In life of the mid-50s?
Didn't know what that meant.
Okay. Who would come up with
this? Besides that, we didn't want them.
No, they messed up the
well, procedure,
yeah.
You know, at that time, design was the thing
right.
in the industry. I think it goes through phases. But at that time, design was the final answer. And we like to keep it that way.
Earl had really built it into a prestigious...
Yes. And the engineers often would come into our place with a lot of awe. And they didn't often suggest too many things because they had early found out that was going to work.
So Earl had probably found this situation when he came there, and as soon as he could, he banished the engineers to a secondary position, silently.
That's right. He'd often talk about the high button shoes and the belt and the suspenders.
Yeah, right, yeah. And the fedoras.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the process? How, supposing,
but of course, all divisions weren't that way. You see, every division was not fortunate enough
to
have an Ed Cole type.
Chevrolet was really important.
He was really the only one. Well, I wouldn't say the only one. I think there were others that came along, but I think when Ed Cole was there, there was nobody else in other divisions that would stand up to him in those problems. But to get back to how do we start?
Yeah.
Well, we all knew that there was to be a new model, and we would have some discussions with other people, and including Goal, about what kind of general things that we wanted to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing was to put pencil on paper and make a bunch of sketches. Some would be too wild, some would be too tame.
Mm-hmm.
Some were just not good enough.
So you
but we would do it out do this in a very free way.
Mm-hmm.
So that we aren't trying to, we're not holding the designer down to trying to hold his pencil for him.
Right.
Because that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to let him do what he can do. And out of all of these reams of paper comes ideas. And then we would gradually start
having review sessions.
And, you know, there wouldn't necessarily be formal reviews that we would have, but we would have discussions and visits from Cole or from Earl or from Andrade or. Follow one line of thinking for several weeks and then throw it away and start down another avenue.
Really?
In the early weeks or months of a new design, you don't have a formal path. You don't have anything set up. And it might be that Earl would be away for 2 or 3 months. We wouldn't see him anyway. Usually when we came back, we started doing another direction.
You did a deadline of sorts.
Sure.
So then, once the decision was made, who would make the final decision? I mean, not on the final final configuration, but when you finally arrived at a concept that everybody was comfortable with, who would make that decision?
Well, I think that went in stages. We would have that internally in the studio.
Right. Then you would present the proposal to me.
Yeah.
Final proposal.
Or I might have 2 or 3 proposals.
Ah, good.
One that I would like.
Yeah,
but
right.
We'd have something else to fall back on.
Uh-huh.
And
they'd say, well, I don't like any of these commands.
Yeah. It could be that.
Uh-huh.
And we were accustomed to that. It didn't offend us too much.
No.
Or we might say, well, he might say, wherever he is, Cole or Earl, wherever, well, this is all right, but maybe you ought to have that to it or do this.
Uh-huh.
And we get this sort of inputs.
What stage would this be? Would this be in the rendering stage?
Yeah. Rendering either in sketch form or full size.
Mm-hmm. What about when you got to the so-called tape?
Well, that would be mixed in.
Yeah, something.
With the full-size renderings.
Right.
For example, on the 1959 Chevrolet, which was the Wildman, bird wings, we experimented a lot with different headlight locations. We were toying with the center headlight and an outboard headlight too.
Uh-huh.
We had several things going in that direction.
Uh-huh.
And that just shows how much we were searching.
Yeah.
And really were no holds back in those days on practicality or convention.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were looking for something that it seemed like the public was ready for that. And of course we'd go overboard.
Mm-hmm. Some of the lot of them right.
Oh yes. Sure. Well, you have to go too far to back up to the right place.
So you would take maybe 2 or 3 sketches that you felt represented the thinking of the department and take them to Earl and first maybe to Cole.
No, we kept them all in the studio.
Why should they come?
They would come to the studio. We never took anything out. That's not a good way to show anything. And quite often when we would show a model, we might have a clay model underway so that they could start to see the three-dimensional part of it.
So what kind of sessions would you have? Would you have knockdown, drag out sessions, or were they pretty simple?
Oh, sure, everything's simplized.
Even though the two volatile characters were often at odds with each other.
Well, I say they were civilized. I sit by what he's been shown and stop out and let me know that when he came back he wanted to see
something he liked.
Something else.
How long will you give him? A week.
How about tomorrow morning?
Really? Oh no. Overtime. This is overtime.
Sure.
How about Cole? How did he? What was his person? He was a little more smoother, a little more different.
Concerned, you know that he was not at all satisfied, and we didn't like to see that. So we would just do our best to make him happy. So we had two different people we had to make happy. At least.
Sure.
At least.
He's excited.
There were tense times.
I could have been. Understood.
Has to carry with you when you go home. Except we weren't home a lot during those times.
You know, the designer's widows in those days, you know, the endless overtime, the endless deadline. When you did get home, you were bashing the hard to relax, a lot of coffee, the endless overtime. You didn't go to sleep enough.
Oh, no, 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 this is 1956.
Absolutely, yeah.
Excuse me, that was my car. That was my own personal car. I bought that. And one night when I was coming home from one of these late evening work sessions, about 11 o'clock, and by this time I lived in Farmington, I was about a mile from home, and I was downshifting or something. I blew the engine. And
you blew it, or I blew it?
Taken into Chevrolet garage, and the next morning Ed Cole was over for a meeting. So after we finished talking about what we had, I told him about this and the engine had run. And he turned to Harry Barr, his assistant chief engineer, and he said, he was his chief engineer this time. He said, why don't you take Max's car and put that new 57 engine in, which was a bigger engine. And while you're at it, put the new 4-speed transmission. And I had a 3-speed 56. And he said, and the fuel injection too. So I did that. And here I had this neat looking car with the next year's fuel injection 4-speed transmission engine.
Some of the joys of obviously, you and Mr. Cole got along fairly well.
Yeah, we did.
And you apparently had a fairly good relationship with Harley.
Off and on. Most of the time.
Really? Yeah.
But, you know, one didn't become close.
No, one didn't approach. But your low key approach is probably low.
Some mix up on the Corvette, and we were something.
The early Corvette?
something on the windshield pillar. I've forgotten what the exact thing was, but he thought that I was playing too close to Ed Cole.
Oh, I see.
So he fired me. In Cole's presence, he really chewed me out. And then I went away with Cole afterwards to our auditorium at the Tech Center and back again. And, you know,
for sure.
Cole was telling me how awfully that early it acted. And then inside of an hour or two, call from Art O'Leary.
Forget it.
Forget it.
He's cooled down.
Well, that's just one of many people that have had it treated. He just got very incensed because he felt that I was doing something against his wishes.
What was this parallel thing that was going on? You're ahead of the Shutter Design, but Bill Mitchell is. Corvette spin-offs. Mako Sharks.
Oh, well, that's...
What was that? So...
This was later on, of course.
Oh, later. Oh, I was thinking it was in the late 50s. It was in the 60s.
Well, this would be after Bill took over. Now, when did he take over?
58. Well, then let me ask you to scrap that. Let me ask you, we'll get that wrong. Let me ask you, what was Bill doing during this time? Now, I think he'd been dispatched to take over Merrill's private business.
That's right.
The early 50s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then he came back.
And he came back right under Harley Earl. Right.
As assistant to design chief.
Yeah.
And just assistant to the vice president.
And with the complete understanding of everybody that he would replace
Merrill. Did he have a divisional title?
Well, Bill would like to be.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, he had a lot of the same ideas. He was taught by Harley, and he knew the things that Harley did that worked well for Harley. But Bill is a different kind of person in a lot of ways. And
Harley. But you still had the same.
They're both good leaders.
Were they? And they. But he was pretty much out of the Merrill protégé. He was grooming him. Hopefully he gets someone in his image that he felt.
Yeah, well, Earl had made it clear to everyone in the corporation that Stiling was running that show. No one was debunking. And Bill, of course, followed along in that same thing because it worked for Harley and it worked for Bill. A lot of years.
Was Mitchell he didn't have quite the flair nationally that Earl had.
No.
Sort of junior version, in a sense. Not to take it any way from him, but
Well, he was a little different. Well, they both tried to be top-notch dressers, but Bill was a little more flamboyant, I guess, in many ways, than Harley was. I think Harley was fortunate in that he knew Sloan so well, because he had this private phone connection.
Tremendous leverage, yeah.
And Bill didn't quite get that, because by this time Sloan wasn't there.
Right. And the chairman that were coming up then,
Fred Donner.
It would be Fred Donner, and that would be Jack Gordon.
Was that when? That was true, I know, in 62 when I went to Germany.
It was true. 58.
All right.
Jack, well, because he tells the story that Jack Gordon said, I understand that Harley should be his replacement, then Mike Brown got that.
Oh, yeah.
I
remember that.
That story.
So, you see, Bill was dealing with different people in Harley was. And Fred Donner didn't have, didn't have the connection bill with it.
Fred stayed in New Orleans, he stayed in New York too, but he was pretty much financial.
Oh, yes. And Donner always had a very mischievous sense of humor.
Oh, did he? How did that manifest?
Well, at parties in Germany, you'd see this come out. Maybe you wouldn't see it in an ordinary.
No.
But he would deliver little remarks. You wondered what he really mean.
That's a good one.
No, I don't think so.
Well, Earl's. Earl's regime is coming to an end, and he's got a handpicked successor. What sort of reaction did that have at the top levels? Were they amenable to this?
Corporation top
level? That you heard about, or probably.
Well, I think the word had been said that Bill was a successor, and they dealt with it.
Mm-hmm. And although there were some minor objections, I think we mentioned that Jack Gordon was a little unhappy with being.
Well, Jack Gordon had dealings with Bill in the Cadillac studio. Jack was head of Cadillac.
I see.
And they were not in agreement then, and Jack remembered that.
Oh, okay.
And Bill was dealing with Ed Cole as chief engineer more than with Jack Gordon, or he agreed with, he and Cole were in agreement on things,
mm-hmm.
which would be contrary. Jack Gordon's voice.
I see.
So I think that's where that originated.
I see. So here he is.
For my money, Bill and Ed Cole were more forward-looking,
mm-hmm.
looking to the future than Jack Gordon. Jack Gordon was very conservative.
Was he? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he did accept. He did accept the fact that Earl wanted Mitchell.
Yes. Yeah, it was not much he could do, but if he serious about it. When Bill was in the early 60s, he became quite involved, well, in the late 50s and the early 60s, became quite involved in sports cars and,
yes.
and then in later motorcycles and, you know, anything that goes fast
and
is fun and enjoyable.
And exciting.
So Corvette was getting pretty big in the sports car racing field at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they cut that off in the 57 or 58, I guess,
mm-hmm. right.
Bill managed to get a hold of the chassis for a special car,
mm-hmm.
which he bought.
Oh.
And he, at his own expense, had it raced a few times. Now, he didn't drive it himself,
mm-hmm.
but he...
Did he put a Corvette body on it?
He put a special body on it.
Special body. Of his own devising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which eventually turned into a version of that turned into the 63 Corvette Stingray. He called it a Stingray.
Yeah, so the Stingray was one of his prized creations.
Now, you were asking about Larry Shinoda.
Yes.
And
that was the genesis of that,
that program. Yeah, they were involved in those cars, and we were busy doing something else, and maybe he thought we weren't qualified to do it. I don't know. At any rate, that's where those came from, and that's how Larry Shinoda
came into a certain prominence in general.
I think Tony Lapine was a little bit involved in it, too.
Was he?
Are you familiar with
Tony
Lapine?
No, tell me about Tony Lapine.
Well, he's an engineer, and when I was in Germany, I had him come over to help me over there, and he ran a engineering-type studio for me.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, the 59 Chevy is a... someone finally realizes that's the end of it. Sort of by mutual consent, everybody sort of signed off on the...
The fins were getting too big and too extreme, and we've got to have something else to do. So I think the 61 and 62 cars were just sort of tamed down a little bit and not as different.
That's right. I had a 60 Chevrolet station wagon, which I ran for 10 years. That was the first of the slightly modified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we started to back off a little bit.
Yeah, so the 61 and 62 were almost completely devoid of the excesses of the 50s, and you started with a new decade and a new model. How'd that come about? What sort of, do you remember any details about how?
Well, I think we all realized, and the public realized, that we had just gone a step or two too far.
Right.
And we had to back off.
I think the 59 Chevy did not sell very well.
No, I think, I remember when the 60s came out, I went to a meeting in Canada, and several people walked up to me and they said, "Now you went and changed it again. We were just getting used to the 1959.
Oh no. You must have thrown up your hand. But inexorably the fins disappeared.
They were excess. They were just, the whole industry just went a little bit crazy.
And strangely enough, the whole industry stopped about the same time. Mm-hmm. I guess.
I think we all got the message.
Right. That 67 that I drove was a beautiful car. And mechanically and stylistically, and the paint and the, there was very little rust, and the engine, I had no major, 10 years, 40,000, 35,000 miles. Beautiful. That was a real workhorse.
Well, as you probably know, that series of V8 engines and chassis just seemed to run forever. Well, you know, it's basically the same as some of the stuff they're doing today, but it just seemed to run on and on and on. I don't think there's ever been an engine in the industry that was any better.
Was that one of Ed Cole's? That was his
55. Basically the 55.
With slight modifications over the next decade or something.
Make it a little bigger.
Yeah.
But basically the same thing.
Beautiful.
With a few problems that came along the way, like air ride. And you never had an air ride car?
No, what was that?
Well, that was where they had little airbags instead of springs.
Oh, I've heard about it. Yeah, Peugeot was.
It was a good idea. In fact, I think Lincoln still uses that.
Right.
Don't they?
Yeah,
but it's been perfected.
Yeah.
I had one.
Did you?
I had a 58 station wagon with an air ride. And the biggest engine you could get. And I went on vacation. Got out in the west in Montana. And the car started to lean to one side. And I drove into a dealer and he just shook his head. Nothing we can do about that. You just go on back to Detroit. Tell them they don't know what they're doing.
They couldn't pump it
up. I stopped at every Chevrolet dealer between there and back to Detroit.
Really?
They all shook their heads.
What was the problem? It deflated and they couldn't pump it up, huh?
The car was so new at the time, they didn't have parts and they didn't know what to do yet.
It was a slow leak?
Yeah.
It was strictly an airbag.
I think I had leaks on two by the time I got back.
Your wife wasn't too happy about this oil big engine. What year was that introduced?
58.
On a limited basis.
And it was only 1 year. Because they saw the error of their ways at the time. It was a good idea, they just hadn't perfected it enough, hadn't tested it enough, I guess. Yeah. Anyway.
When did Ed leave the Chevrolet division? Oh, before that, let's talk about the Corvair. Can you give us a sort of a blow-by-blow description of how the Corvair came into being?
Well, that again was purely an Ed Cole idea.
It wasn't in response to anything that anyone else was doing?
I don't think so. I think it was an offshoot from the VW.
Was it?
And he wanted an air-cooled engine car.
Rear engine.
I didn't, and Ned Nichols did that car.
Did
I had nothing to do with that.
I see.
That first one.
Under your general supervision, or had you left?
No. Nick was running a special project studio.
I see.
And that was his assignment. He did that that car.
Was he working for you now?
No.
No.
No, he was independent.
Okay. He's working for Ed Cole.
Yeah. And so I really had nothing to do with it, but it was a great car.
It was a European influence. What was his reason for it? Did he ever give any rationale as to why?
Well, I think he wanted a lower-priced car.
Mm-hmm.
Air-cooled, so there are no coolant problems.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of an air-cooled car was a rear-engine car.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great car in the snow and the mud, because your weight is where the traction is.
Right.
Terrific car.
us in on it.
Almost single-handedly.
Almost single-handedly, yeah. Well.
Well, basically, though.
With the help of our president.
Yeah. Looking back on it, the help of your then president, yeah, right. We'll talk about that in a minute. Looking back on it, though, what was wrong with the car? Was there an instability? Did the rear.
Well, let's say I didn't notice it, and I owned.
Did you?
Two of them. Right? I had a convertible in Germany that was the car that Monkey Knudsen had in this country. First convertible built. Monkey Knudsen had, and he drove it a couple times and that was it. And I bought it and had it sent over to Germany. And my wife drove that for 5 years over there.
One of the early Corvair.
Loved it.
One of the early Corvair convertibles. What year was that?
62.
By this time, are you getting feelers that change might be in order? When did you first hear about the Opel assignment?
I had been in Chevrolet for about 10 years, and 10 years is a long time to be in one spot.
How many years were you chief assigned?
9.5 years, nine years, something
like that. Pretty much your whole tenure, yeah. You didn't think you were getting stale.
Well, I didn't think so.
What was the rationale of normal rotation?
Yeah, I was getting a little tired of doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And
had Ed moved on by this time?
Yeah.
Who was
so there was probably some of that too that I was didn't have the same rapport with.
Who was the new division chief at that time? Who succeeded? Was it Estes?
Knudsen. Well, we were only there together for
a short
time, so really hadn't gotten to know each other very well. And I, of course, I saw him later in overseas because he became head of overseas.
That's right. What had been the history of Opel up until this time?
Let's go back and talk about how the corporation viewed Opel.
Please.
And Opel had started to make cars again after the war. But they never developed a car that was satisfactory to the people here.
Mm-hmm.
It was always their reputation in Germany was to build a good, solid family car. Something for the baker to use or the
the butcher.
Or the butcher, that type of thing.
Right.
But not a real car like Mercedes builds.
Uh-huh.
And
did you still have the president and senator in those days?
Oh, no.
What were the names in those days?
No, in those days it was just the the Rekord, which was their medium-sized car. Small car, really.
R-E-C-O-R-D.
Or R-E-K-O-R-D over there.
Where'd that come from? Where'd they get the name? Odd name.
It is to our ears, yes.
Yeah. What did it mean in German?
Well, the only thing I know is it means record.
Okay.
But it's sort of an odd name, yeah.
It's like some of the Japanese
names. It's really, really odd to our ears.
The record, and what else did they have?
They had a bigger car. And we changed all the names shortly.
I think we earlier established that Adam Opel had started that probably around sometime during the first decade or two of the century.
Well, this Opel started out as a sewing machine manufacturer.
Was that its genesis?
And a bicycle
sewing machine
manufacturer.
Okay.
And then they got into cars late in the 1800s. They started to experiment. Yeah, very early in the game.
Really? Okay.
And then through the early 1900s, they were improving their breed a little bit, and they got into as a sideline into race cars, and I suppose this was just to build the reputation up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got serious in the 20s, but it always seemed to be sort of a family ordinary type car. Nothing sensational.
Yeah.
Solid, reliable.
Uh-huh. Bourgeois.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of like Pontiac was in prior to Bunky Knudsen.
Right. Uh-huh.
Very similar.
Uh-huh.
And so the corporation over here decided that this has got to change a little bit. We need to send some styling man over who will change their look, change their reputation, change the feeling about Opel.
Right.
So I was sent over.
You had had a spectacular success with the Chevrolet division. Well regarded as a...
Yeah, I suppose that...
designer was your dash and flair.
And so I went over in, on my birthday in 1962, March 10th.
Who called you in and said, you're going here, how would you like to go?
Well, Bill Mitchell called me in and said, we have this request. And I recommended you.
Oh,
and would you like to take it?
Uh-huh.
He didn't tell me.
That's good.
He left it up to me.
Uh-huh.
So it sounded good to me. And I went home and I talked to Edie, and it sounded good to her.
Uh-huh.
We talked to some of her kids. And they were just
they were
happy about it. But they didn't know.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we kept this quiet for a few weeks. And finally I went over in March. Alone.
Not much preparation for shifting personnel in those days.
No.
You were pretty much the first one. What sort of...
Well, I was the only one outside of GM Overseas over there.
I see.
Since then, there have been for a number, and now it's reduced for other reasons. But anyway.
What were they doing at Opel, you know, anticipating? What sort of situation did you find there?
When I went over there, they were building the Record, which was sort of out of date, and the big car, which was really out of date. It still had the wraparound windshield, and you remember the roof on the Corvair, which extended out over the backlight?
Right.
Which is looking very old-fashioned by this time. And those people are happy with it. They love it. They think it's great.
What year was this again?
1962.
Right.
But obviously, the people, the buyers, aren't as enthused as the Opel people were.
Who were your
because the sales had fallen considerably.
Who were your competitors in those days?
Well,
at that level. Did any of the German firms have
Mercedes had some smaller cars, but higher priced.
Yeah.
BMW was just getting out of the war problems.
Right.
They still hadn't gotten much.
Yeah. Price struggle,
there were some French manufacturers.
What about NSU?
They were below us, and while I was there, they brought out the RO80, which was a rotary engine.
Oh.
NSU, and that was more in our
the early
class.
Michael.
Yeah. There wasn't the number of competitors at the time, because they were still suffering from the war problems.
Sure. They didn't have your infusion of capital on the personnel.
Right. So the first thing we did was bring out a new car, and we call it the, the Diplomat, and then we brought an up-priced version of the Record, which we called the Commodore. Now it was basically the new Record, but with a more plush interior and bigger tires and so on. And also, just a few months after I got there, they brought out a Cadet. Not the Cadet that was sold here, but the predecessor to that, which was just a little square box.
Had that been set up before you got there?
That was all done before I got there, except for a few
touches,
last minute touches. And it was well on the way, and they'd built a new plant at Bochum, which is north of the Rüsselsheim area.
No, spell Rüsselsheim.
Rüsselsheim.
Spell Bochum.
Bochum. Well, Bochum was an all-new plant, all done from scratch, so it was modern.
But an Opel plant, yeah.
An Opel plant. The Rüsselsheim plant, as I said, was about 60% bombed out by the Americans during the war. And I swear, that plant, which was built in 1912 or so, was rebuilt with the same plans that they built the original.
Nothing modern.
Nothing. And when I went over there, my headquarters was on top of the engineering
building, which was part of the plant, part of the old plant. And it consisted of a one large room, which was our auditorium, our design room, and part of our construction room. Another little cubby hole, which was part of the fabrication area. And a little deck outside, which is twice as big as this. Deck out here, maybe 30 by 40 feet, which was our show place outside in the snow or rain or whatever, and we had a lot of rain.
Yeah. Where is Rüsselsheim?
Rüsselsheim is about 10 miles from the Frankfurt airport.
And that's in northwest Germany, right?
Yeah. Very close to the airport.
What did you find when you got there?
It's right on the Main River. The Main River runs right by the
Mainz.
Main. Mainz is a city on the Rhine-Main connection.
So how do you spell Main River? The Main River.
Main.
Yeah. So what did you find when you went over there? You found an antiquated plant. You found a. What was your first move? Do you remember what you said?
Well, my first move, I was called into the assistant. The place was run by a man who had experience in India and Arabia selling refrigerators and whatever. And he had been called in to run the biggest plant in the corporation.
When you say run the plant, run the
General manager. Managing director, they call him.
Works manager. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's more than a works manager.
No, he's managing director.
He runs the place. And I was called in by his assistant. His assistant was a man who had been with Opel before the war, and then he was Jewish, so he had to get out. When the Nazis really took over. And then he was called back and he was second in command there.
He escaped the Nazi presence.
And he set me down across from him and he fiddled through his desk and he said, one of my things I insisted on before I went there was that I would not work for the engineering department. I had to report directly to the managing director. They agreed to that.
Yeah.
So he repeated that again. He said, "Now we're going to have you report directly to Nelson Stork."
Mm-hmm. I spelled that.
S-T-O-R-K. Managing director. And he said, "You've worked for Styling for a lot of years." He said, "You're not going to do any of those things like that Oldsmobile that I saw over there last year, are you? With all of that chrome on it? Because the Germans don't like a lot of chrome. They like things simpler." And we had a few words about design. Well, I had no intention of duplicating the Oldsmobile because I didn't like it when it came out and I don't like it now. Anyway,
what was your reply?
I told him I was going to design good cars and not duplicates of those chrome-laden vehicles that he was talking about. But I've got to say this, that maybe it was lack of experience on Stork and the Stork's part and the other management at Opel.
What was his name, by the way? This isn't right.
Gaston DeWolf, DeWolffe. Still lives here, still lives in near the plant. At any rate, the management there left me alone to do what I wanted to do. And I would invite them over to look at whatever we were proposing. And either through their ignorance of what I was doing or good faith or whatever,
they didn't discuss it too much. They just agreed to it, and that's fine. It's the first time I ever had that happen to me.
Perfect, yeah. what a marvelous opportunity. So who came up with the general idea to upgrade? Well, obviously one of your...
Well, that was known before I came over. I had discussions with Bill Mitchell and a few of the other vice presidents over here as to what the general thing was that we were going to do. We took some ideas from the States and doctored them to fit the conditions over there and came up with a new car fairly rapidly.
Your choice of names is interesting. They have a ring of authority and
now those are German names. Those are names that the Germans felt would be right for their market.
Oh, good. So that was their input. Mm-hmm. They came up with the names that they thought would be acceptable and attractive to the Germans.
Yes, their marketing people, salespeople, okay, felt those were the right names.
Did you ever raise your eyebrows at these names or smile a bit?
Well, I think Commodore is every bit as good a name as some animal.
Fine, oh yeah.
And it probably fits their
and it has a
culture.
Sort of air about it, of authority.
A little bit of military in it.
Right. The Germans loved that, didn't they? Even after the war, they still loved a sort of a martial ring to it.
Yeah. I love the German people. I just thought they were terrific. Mm-hmm. You know, not everybody, but
yeah,
by and large.
Did you have problems with ex-Nazis showing up in various conditions? Good, they were gone. Pretty much
they were solid.
Yeah.
They all fought, the ones that fought, and they all fought, really. All fought on the Eastern Front. Never saw anybody that fought
on the Western Front. If they did, they carried me too.
Strangely enough, a lot of them had been imprisoned in Texas. And I never figured out, if you fought the Russians, how you got imprisoned in Texas.
But you were too diplomatic to ask.
No use asking.
You knew.
But one of the first things, we knew that the cadet was coming out, so
yeah,
we did a few things to that, and then...
That's K-A...
K-A-D-E-T-T.
Yeah. There's no E on it, is there?
No.
No.
And then the next...
Again, it's sort of a junior Commodore.
Yeah, yeah.
A diminutive naval.
Yeah, well, that was a... Before the war, there was a cadet.
That's right.
And the Russians took that, all those dies, I believe.
Did they?
So they had nothing left. They had to build their own over again. And this car was designed totally by the engineering department, and it sort of looked like it. I mean, it had the input of what they call the styling department, but that was under Hans Mersheimer. Mersheimer.
He was your predecessor?
No. Well, yes, he was chief engineer.
Yeah. Okay.
Wasn't, and before I went, and after.
Okay, good.
And he had been told that this little playground that he had, the styling department, was being taken from him and put in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice about it.
Mm-hmm.
My face, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And we got along most of the time very well.
Of course, you had an engineering background.
Yeah.
Not made in the woods.
Yeah. And, you know, he'd been told by a higher authority, so he accepted that. And it's all right. And we worked together very well most of the time. About that time, and I had known this beforehand that I would have to do it, we had to have a new building. We couldn't do the things that I had been asked to do with 29 people and two rooms and the kind of equipment that I had. So we needed a lot of new equipment, we needed new people, and we needed a building to work in. About 3 or 4 months after I got there, they had a big celebration, 100th anniversary of Opel. 1862 it was created. This was in 1962. And it was attended by the board of directors and a lot of top guests from all over the world.
Including Detroit and New York.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Australia and, you know, wherever Opels are sold. Top people were there, and we
during that celebration, which lasted 3 or 4 days, Jack Gordon and Fred Donner called me and said they'd like to see me. And
this is in Rüsselsheim?
In Rüsselsheim. Just the two of them. Mm-hmm. Bill Mitchell was there, but he wasn't included in the meeting. They talked to me privately, because I guess they wanted to see what kind of a guy they had over there and what I was doing and what I had to say about a new building. So at this meeting, I told them what I needed in the way of a new building and equipment and manpower and roughly what it would cost the corporation to get it. They said, do what you've got to do.
Right.
I mean, it was that simple. Wow. So their mind is already made up.
They just wanted to check it out.
Yeah. So we started, and I worked with the people that build buildings for Opel. And they, you know, they were all ready to rebuild the old plant.
Right, the third time.
Third time. And I'd let them know that that was not going to do. And I still had the building of our tech center in mind. And I acquired a fellow from design staff who was familiar with that and helped me out and took a lot of that load off my mind.
Who was that?
Ted Moon.
Oh, of course. Oh, that's so Ted Moon just came over from...
Yeah.
At your instigation.
Right.
And what was his input?
Well, he knew a lot of the details of the building that I didn't know. And he just physically took a lot of that off my shoulders.
Uh-huh.
Because we were designing cars too.
Sure.